This is KUNC's Colorado Edition. I'm Catherine Welch.
And I'm Brian Larson. Healthcare has been marked by partisan divisions nationally for the last few years. But in Colorado, lawmakers from both parties are getting on board with a few healthcare bills. We'll take a closer look.
It's not all harmony at the state capitol. State lawmakers are sparring over a bill that would essentially bypass the Electoral College system.
Republicans say this is an end run around the United States Constitution and a way to effectively bring partisan politics into a system that has been tried and true.
And Eagle County on the western slope has big gaps in mental health services.
There's like no homeless shelters, right? It's really hard to get someone into counseling. Most of the therapists charge a lot or they are fully booked. So it is a lot of challenges.
But the county is working to create a better system for its residents. We check in on the innovative way the county is funding it and if it's working.
Plus, our film critic Howie Moshevitz has more on a couple of the films that are emerging as his favorites in the upcoming Denver Jewish Film Festival.
But first, federal employees have gone back to work after the record 35-day government shutdown, including those at Farm Service Agency offices around the country. KUNC's Esther Honig visited one and found farmers eager to sign up for crucial safety net programs and federal workers sifting through a backlog of paperwork.
In Greeley, Colorado, FSA employee Shelley Woods shows off three large stacks of folders that require immediate attention. She's her family's breadwinner, and missing two paychecks turned her into a nervous wreck.
It was great coming back. It's just trying to get caught up.
The few farmers who stopped by, including Ron Farmer, were enrolling in the Market Facilitation Program, which pays producers who are affected by the ongoing trade war.
So we were waiting to report our bushels, which is what I'm in here for today.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture extended the deadline to apply for payouts until Valentine's Day. Esther Honig, Harvest Public Media.
It's expensive to live in Fort Collins. A new study by the city finds one of the factors may be the U+2 housing ordinance. It limits home occupancy to no more than 3 unrelated people per household. So, even if a house has 5 bedrooms, only 3 people can live in it unless they are a family. You following along there, Brian?
I think I can do the math on this. Tristan Siron is student body president for Colorado State University. He says the problem is so bad that CSU is buying up land in the area because faculty and staff can't afford to live in the city.
You can work in Fort Collins, you can play in Fort Collins, but you have to live somewhere else. So the amount of people I learned that have to wake up in Loveland to drive to work simply because they can't afford living here, that's a problem that I think is going to start causing a lot of public pressure.
Both CSU and the mayor of Fort Collins have proposed a U+3 and a right-size housing policy where 4 people could live in a 4-bedroom house. If the city doesn't do anything, Siron says voters could see a ballot measure in November.
And now a follow-up to a story that we reported on at this time last year. Eagle County had just started taxing recreational marijuana. The revenue was going to be used to pay for mental health services for its residents. The area on the western slope has higher rates of mental illnesses and suicides than the rest of the state.
KUNC's Matt Bloom recently returned to Eagle to see how things are going and what challenges still lie ahead.
Compared to the rest of the state, the town of Eagle on the western slope has a higher rate of mental illnesses and suicides. It's something they're actively trying to change. It's 9 a.m., and things are already getting busy for the 4 mental health clinicians at the Eagle County Paramedics Building. They've just got a call from Eagle County Sheriff's Department about a potentially suicidal person and are getting ready to deploy.
We want to spend time with them and just talk to them versus just doing a risk assessment and leaving.
That's John Medvekis. He quickly puts on his gloves and a dark blue cap and heads for the door.
When we get back, we get sort of download with you.
Medvekis is part of the Hope Center, Eagle River Valley. It's a new mental health program funded by the county's year-old 2.5% sales tax on recreational marijuana.
Our job is to keep people out of the hospital.
Julia Goldbert says they'll go anywhere within the county to provide on-the-spot counseling. Costco, Loaf and Jug, individual homes, and all for free.
It could be anybody in the community. So any age, usually fights with family, has been a few times that they've come to us from that, or the family's called in. Or a lot of times they're just calling and they're like, you know, I'm feeling really, really depressed. I'm really not feeling well. Can you help me? Can I talk to you? What should I do next?
And once they respond, a patient is under their care for 3 days.
How was it, guys?
It was good.
About 2 hours after he left, John Medvekis is back in briefing the team. The person he met with was depressed, but not in immediate danger.
This individual, we decided that they did not meet criteria for hospitalization, and then we went to our safety plan.
That involves a series of daily phone or in-person check-ins. Ultimately, they want to guide patients toward long-term care, but those types of services in Eagle County are hard to find right now.
There's like no homeless shelters, right? It's really hard to get someone into counseling. Most of the therapists charge a lot or they are fully booked. So it is a lot of challenges.
Including the marijuana sales tax. It's generated $400,000 since last February. But Commissioner Jeannie McQueenie says it's only half of what they were anticipating, meaning they don't have enough money to address all their needs.
I would like to say yes, it is. And because I know of some stories where it is, but I also know of some stories where it's not. So it's still a matter of connecting people to the services, and it's still a matter of creating more services for people.
More than 200 people have called the Hope Center since it opened just 3 months ago.
The stigma has gone down significantly, and people are willing to talk about it and willing to reach out. And so that's where I see the biggest impact that we've had.
But despite those gains, 2018 was another record-breaking year for suicides in Eagle County. Even with the tax rate going up, leaders like McQueenie know they need to do more. That's why they're looking at sources of funding beyond the tax.
Great, okay.
Chris Lindley is the county's director of public health.
We'll give it a few more seconds here.
He's hosting a conference call with representatives from Vail Health, the county paramedics division, and state lawmakers.
We just can't do it. Like, there's not enough money. We all got to pull together. And having a joint fundraising arm or something to hit those most critical gaps is what's going to help us address it.
That's even with the county chipping in an additional $500,000 from its emergency reserves. Private foundations and local law enforcement are also contributing.
We're not trying to, you know, patch this up for a year or two. We want long-term solutions in this community.
To do what they really want, including walk-in clinics and hiring more school-based counselors, Lindley can only guess at a price. And that's at least 10 times what they have now.
I don't think in a year we'll certainly be there. But I think in a year we're going to have the infrastructure in place to raise the funds. We'll know how much we need to raise, and we're going to have a strategy to do it, and we're going to be working on it.
Back at the Hope Center, John Medvekis says they've already gotten to the point where they need more help beyond just the four of them that work there.
We'd like to hire two more full-time clinicians and also hire a full-time supervisor and clinical lead person.
Towards the end of the afternoon, another call comes in. Medvekis and another clinician rush into a private room. On the floor just outside the door, they flip on a white noise machine. It's meant to muffle the conversation inside and ensure privacy. They do it for every call. Even though the ultimate vision for a better mental health care system in Eagle and Eagle County is still far off, the team is doing what they can to get another person the help they need. Matt Bloom, KUNC, Eagle.
The 2020 presidential election is gearing up, with several Democratic candidates already getting into the race.
And of course, we're still waiting to hear if former Colorado Governor John Hickenlooper will toss his hat into that large ring.
But in the meantime, Colorado lawmakers are debating a proposal that could change the way the state allocates its electoral votes.
But before we get to that story, military service is the one thing freshman Congressman Jason Crow shares with Mike Kaufman, the Republican he ousted in last year's election. KUNC's Michael DeJuana spoke to Crow about the possibility of peace in Afghanistan, his role on the Armed Services Committee, and the effort to rein in the role of money in politics.
You were in Afghanistan in the early 2000s with the Army as part of the Joint Special Operations Task Force. Does that experience inform what you think a U.S. withdrawal from the region should look like?
And having firsthand experience dealing with folks on the ground there certainly informs my approach to it and my desire, A, to make sure that we're ending what has now become our longest war. You know, we're spending $55 billion a year. Thousands of American soldiers and Marines and others have been killed, tens of thousands wounded. We have to make sure that we're ending this, but also doing it responsibly and keeping our promises and maintaining our obligations to the folks on the ground there and the Afghanis as well.
What do you think the U.S. history books will say about the U.S. war in Afghanistan?
You know, that remains to be seen. And what's going to happen over the next couple of months and in the next year, I think, is going to be really important. The U.S. envoy and the Taliban negotiators have apparently arrived at a framework for continued discussions. So I look forward to seeing what that framework outlines and how we're able to withdraw our troops. But also do it in a responsible way that maintains our obligations to the Afghan people and ensures our national security and also makes sure that the Taliban respects the Afghan government, and we're promoting democracy and good governance initiatives in Afghanistan as well. Those are all things that are important. And as they say, you know, the devil's in the details. So we're going to have to look really closely at the details of any agreement in the months ahead.
You're serving on the Armed Services Committee. What other issues are getting your attention there?
Well, there's a lot of need, both domestically and abroad. I'm on the Readiness Subcommittee. You know, that's a great committee for the community. It's going to put me in a good position to make sure I'm advocating for Buckley Air Force Base and the other military installations in Colorado as we improve those facilities and look at where we're investing in our force throughout the country, but also making sure that we're making investments in using DOD purchasing power to green the force. You know, Fort Hood in Texas is actually 100% energy independent right now. They're saving $4 million a year. They're actually more secure because they're off the grid. And I'd like to use that example and see how we can scale that throughout the rest of DOD.
Beyond the military, one issue you say must be addressed is the role of money in politics. Tell me a little more about that.
Well, there are a lot of really pressing legislative issues that we can't kick the can on anymore, from gun violence prevention to campaign finance reform to the crisis of climate change to the need for quality, affordable health care. But, you know, underpinning all of that is, the structural issue of campaign finance reform. You know, we're not going to make efforts on, specific legislative proposals until we start cleaning up our system, making sure that the influx of dark, unaccountable money is not governing what happens here in Washington. So that's why I was a proud original sponsor of H.R. 1 and a member of the Reformers group that pushed very hard for this Ethics, Campaign Finance, and Voting Rights Reform Act to be the first order of business.
You mentioned H.R. 1, House Resolution 1. It addresses ethics, lobbying. Democratic leaders have made it their number one priority, and they're the ones backing this bill. So how do you reach Republicans on this issue?
You know, across the board during my campaign, when I was out hundreds of events talking to thousands of people, Democrats, Republicans, independents, they all said this is something they want to see. This is something that they support because, you know, we have to clean up money in politics. We have to make sure, regardless of your political affiliation, that folks are reflecting their community and doing the will of the American people. We're going to be pushing hard to get support here in Washington from everybody on these important initiatives. And at the end of the day, the American people deserve to know where their representatives stand on this issue.
Before we go, I want to ask about the partial government shutdown. The clock is ticking and President Donald Trump is still pushing for a border wall. What can be done to avert a second shutdown?
Well, you know, with this administration, you know, anything is possible, unfortunately. You know, he's very unpredictable and, his position on these issues seems to change by the hour at this point. But at the end of the day, you know, we have to get our work done. We're going to be pursuing our legislative agenda, cleaning up government, addressing the issues that are important for the community and for our country. And we have some great, very seasoned negotiators on our side that are going to try to hash out a deal. And I am optimistic that we can get that done.
That was KUNC's Michael DeJuana speaking with freshman Congressman Jason Crow, who represents Colorado's 6th Congressional District.
Nationally, healthcare has been a partisan issue for the last few years, but in Colorado, it's emerging as a top priority for both Democrats and Republicans at the state capitol. And as KUNC's Scott Franz reports, some of the early legislation being proposed this session is already packing legislative hearing rooms.
One of the bills would add autism to a list of conditions that can be treated with medical marijuana. Similar legislation was vetoed by Governor Hickenlooper last year.
I haven't found a pediatrician yet who thinks it's a good idea to sign this bill.
But new Governor Jared Polis has already indicated his support for marijuana reform, and more than 100 people showed up at a hearing about the bill, including Margaret Terlahi. She told lawmakers what her family's life was like before she started giving her son medical marijuana.
He headbangs, punches himself, kicks himself, sometimes up to 1,000 times a day. When we were stationed in Georgia, he had beat his ears so bad that he needed surgery twice.
They tried giving him Risperdal and Abilify, which are the only medicines the Food and Drug Administration has approved for autism.
Both made him drool. They also caused liver problems, kidney problems. Right before moving here, my son started urinating blood.
His condition qualified him for a medical marijuana prescription, and she says it's changed his personality.
He's a very special boy. He's not aggressive towards others. He only hurts himself, but all he wants to do is cuddle 24/7. And medical cannabis helped with that.
Terlahi was one of several mothers who testified, but others in the hearing room, like Dr. Dave Downs of the Colorado Medical Society, told lawmakers that cannabis has its risks.
There's clear evidence that marijuana in developing brains is associated with harm to attention, cognition, executive control, memory, problem solving, and other brain issues.
He urged the 11-member House Health and Insurance Committee to reject the bill. But in the end, Committee Chair Susan Lahntein voted with five other Democrats and four Republicans to advance the legislation.
To the parent that said, I would rather give my child medical marijuana than watch them beat their head against the wall. For those folks, I will be a yes vote.
The committee also approved a bipartisan bill that aims to bring down the costs of health care in rural and mountain communities. Republican Representative Mark Catlin of Montrose is one of the sponsors.
All four counties that I represent are in a situation where there's only one health care plan that they can buy into. And, you know, I'm not good about monopolies, you know, and I understand business and all those kind of things, but it does bother me we only have one that we can talk about. And we've got people over there who need insurance. They truly do.
The proposal calls for the state to spend $500,000 to study a public insurance option. Democrat Dylan Roberts represents Rout and Eagle counties, which have some of the highest insurance premiums in the state.
Coloradans deserve more choice, more competition when they're purchasing health insurance so that they actually can buy a plan that gives them the peace of mind and security for themselves and their families, that they will never go bankrupt because of a health scare.
Republican Susan Beckman was one of just two lawmakers to vote against the bill. She represents Littleton and other cities in Arapahoe County, just south of Denver. She was skeptical of the study and whether the government needs to intervene.
Every time government gets involved and puts more money into the system, it gets worse.
The legislation now goes to the Appropriations Committee to see if there is money in the budget to pay for it. The third bill heard by the committee was the least controversial measure. It's a bill allowing pharmacists to prescribe chronic condition medications like insulin in emergency situations. It passed unanimously, and it also got approval on the House floor. From the state capitol, I'm Scott Franz.
Also at the Capitol, Democrats are one step closer to changing the way Colorado's 9 electoral votes are awarded in presidential elections to ensure that if a presidential candidate wins the popular vote but loses the electoral vote, they would still win the election.
Now, the seeds for the National Popular Vote Initiative were planted after the 2000 election, in which Democrat Al Gore won the popular vote but lost the electoral vote to Republican George W. Bush. You remember the Hanging Chads?
Oh, the Hanging Chads.
Who could forget the Hanging Chads? And the 2016 election reignited the debate over whether the Electoral College system is outdated.
Here in Colorado, Governor Jared Polis says he supports the measure, which Democrats say will ensure a one-person, one-vote principle. Colorado Sun political reporter Jesse Aaron Paul has been following Senate Bill 42. Our colleague Aaron O'Toole spoke to him about the effort.
This passed along party lines in the state Senate, basically with no Republican support. What is their argument against it? Why don't they think this is a good idea?
Republicans say this is an end run around the United States Constitution and a way to effectively bring partisan politics into a system that has been tried and true. They feel like states like Colorado, which don't have big populations like California or Texas or Ohio or Florida, would then be kind of snuffed out. Their voices would be snuffed out when it comes to presidential elections. One senator pointed out that Colorado has had 19 presidential candidates visit in the 2016 presidential election cycle, while states like North Dakota and Wyoming had zero. So their concern is that effectively Colorado just wouldn't be paid attention to because it doesn't have the population of other states.
A couple of GOP senators offered up some amendments as this was being debated. What can you say about those?
They offered a wave of amendments to try and stymie its passage or slow it down, if you will. One of them was asking Democrats to put the decision of whether or not to join this compact to a statewide vote. Democrats voted that one down. And then Republicans offered another amendment, kind of a comical one. Some people might call it a troll amendment, that mandates that Colorado would vote for whoever California votes for president. So the state's electors would vote for whoever California's electors would vote for president, as a way to kind of point out or protest the idea that Colorado would be at the whim of larger states with bigger populations if they join this compact.
Even if this is signed into law by Governor Polis, it would only go into effect nationally if enough states adopt it. I know this doesn't exactly work with a number of states, but what is needed?
The compact only goes into effect if there are enough states that sign onto the compact to represent 270 electoral votes, which is the number of votes that you need to win the presidency. And so far, there's 11 states and Washington, D.C. that have signed on or adopted the policy. So Colorado would be the 12th state if Senate Bill 42 passes and signs into law. So right now, with the number of states that are signed on, there are about 172 electoral votes that are represented. If Colorado joins, there'll be 181 electoral votes represented. So they're not there yet. They're not at that 270 number yet. They're a ways off. But there's a number of other states that are considering similar measures. And this is a conversation, again, that's been going on for about two decades, so it's not going to end anytime soon.
Good to know. Anything else that we should know about this?
I think that Governor Jared Polis' decision to support this bill is something that is politically notable. It's a bill that certainly has drawn a lot of passionate voices on both sides of the aisle. And the governor is a new governor, and sticking his neck out into such a controversial issue while he's fighting for other things that take political capital is something that people who are following the Capitol and following legislation should certainly pay attention to.
That was Aaron O'Toole speaking with Colorado Sun political reporter Jesse Aaron Paul.
The 23rd Denver Jewish Film Festival is February 6th through the 18th, with a schedule that includes 29 features. KUNC film critic Howie Mofshevitz, who teaches film and television at CU Denver, is especially fond of two of the films in the festival.
I've only seen a few of the festival films, but these two had real power, a Hungarian film called Budapest Noir and The Interpreter, a movie from Slovakia. Right off the bat, Budapest Noir looks like a descendant of the great American noir films from the 1940s and 50s. This film's in color, but otherwise it starts like a typical noir. A lonely, haggard guy walks down a wet cobblestone city street at night. He's backed by the sound of a trumpet that's as lonely as he is. He's a reporter, and there's been a murder. The victim may have been a prostitute, and the reporter, Zygmunt, wonders why no one seems inclined to investigate. So, of course, he does. His only ally, noir style, is the rumpled guy who sells cigarettes late at night from a tiny, suitably grimy, hole-in-the-wall shop. Lots of films try to imitate American film noir, but most of them stop at the clichés. Exaggerated devious women, a superficially grubby lead man, a brutal world confusing for no particular reason. Actual noir, though, was usually based on something back in the past that no one wants to acknowledge, and that's what causes the disturbance in the world now. In those American pictures, the unmentioned past was World War II, and the men who fought in that war are vulnerable and shaken. Now we call that state PTSD. For Budapest Noir, the back there is the present, and it's potent. The time is 1936, with fascism and anti-Semitism rising in Hungary, and Hitler is not considered a bad guy. The dead woman was Jewish, and this was not a simple murder, if there is ever such a thing. Budapest Noir has a restlessness inside it. It doesn't just rework old film noir. It's interested in the present in another way, which is our now. Fascism and anti-Semitism are again rising in Hungary, and Budapest Noir looks right at it. The interpreter looks at the present also, but from another direction, the problem of memory. How do we deal with the Shoah or the Holocaust now? Those events that took place in the 1930s and 40s, which are as important as ever and still have to be understood again and again. Ali Unger, an 80-year-old Jewish man from Slovakia with a gun in his pocket, knocks on an apartment door in Vienna. He's learned that the former SS officer who lives here murdered his parents during the war. A 70-year-old retired teacher, Georg Graubner, answers the door and tells the older man that his father's long dead. And after a few strange and awkward moments, the 70-year-old asks the older man to travel back to Slovakia with him as his interpreter. He wants to learn about his father. You know something's wacky when the two guys drive off in a hot pink Mercedes. And from there, the interpreter's an unexpected, unpredictable mix of the comic and the dead serious. There's no comedy, there's nothing funny about the extermination of 10 million people. But there is an absurdity that's often funny about these two men together searching for information. Along their way, the two wind up in a hunting camp, they have to share a bed, they dance at the wedding of people they don't know, and they confront their histories. In one of the crucial exchanges of the film, the son of the SS man asks Unger's daughter if it's worse to be the son of the murderer or the son of the victims. What could be the answer to such a question? But the interpreter makes it and the story of the Holocaust crucial for right now. Two extraordinary actors lead this stunning movie. As the younger man, Peter Simonischek, who played the lead in the remarkable Tony Erdmann, and as the older man, Jerry Menzel, the great director of Closely Watched Trains. For KUNC, I'm Howie Mofshevitz.
And one last thing to share with you before we get out of here. Hamilton fans in Colorado will have another shot at seeing the popular Broadway show. KUNC arts reporter Stacy Nick has more. I am not throwing away
my shot. The popular Broadway show will return to Denver for a 7-week run at the Buell Theater in August 2020. However, there's no word yet on when tickets will go on sale. The Denver Center for the Performing Arts expects high demand for the tickets, similar to what it saw when Hamilton came to town last year. At its peak, more than 150,000 people were logged in to the DCPA's online box office. The show helped the theater organization's record-breaking year, with ticket sales alone pouring more than $190 million into the economy. Stacy Nick, KUNC.
Now, I don't want to get my hopes up, Brian, but many people tried forever to get tickets last time. And I heard that at one point, something like 27 million people were in the queue. It broke records, but it also broke hearts. And it was definitely a world turned upside down.
Well, don't give up. Maybe this is your shot at getting some tickets this time around.
There you go.
Well, this has been Colorado Edition, made possible with support from KUNC members.
If you enjoy listening and you're not a member, please consider making a contribution in any amount at KUNC.org. Our show this week was produced by Aaron O'Toole.
And me, Brian Larson. News director Catherine Welch contributed to our show, along with editor Jackie High, who manages digital.
Our intro music is Remember Me by Colorado musician Kalatana. We also heard Robbie Reverb with Bling Bong, and other music in this episode was provided by Blue Dot Sessions.
If you like what you're hearing, make sure you never miss an episode. Subscribe to Colorado Edition at KUNC.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
And join us next Sunday evening at 9 on KUNC.